Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 4th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. We are pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. Dr. Herbert Lin is the Chief Scientist in the Computer Science and Technology Telecommunications Board at the National Academy of Sciences. He's joined today by Mr. Paul Rosenzweig, who's the principal at Red Branch Law and Consulting here in the Washington, D.C. area. And Paul Rosenzweig is the author of a new book, Cyber Warfare, How Conflicts in Cyberspace Are Challenging America and Changing the World. And that, of course, is available in bookstores and also at Amazon.com. A link to that book Amazon page was made available in the flyers and is available on the Federalist Society website as well, as are the speaker's full bios. So I'm going to stop there with the introductions and turn things over to Mr. Rosenzweig, who's going to begin with opening remarks of about 10 minutes. Then we'll hear from Dr. Herbert Lin, and then we'll get to the caller questions. But with that, Mr. Rosenzweig, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Great. Thanks a lot for having me, Dean. It's always a pleasure to participate in the Federalist Society podcast. What I want to posit as the thesis for my remarks today is that the international internet governance question is the most important legal question that you probably haven't considered or thought of before, you being most of the people who are listening to the call, unless you're an expert, of course, in which case you've thought about it a lot. And the reason I say it's the most important question you probably haven't thought of is because it's one that has not yet been determined and that affects a domain, cyberspace, that is probably the most dynamic engine of economic growth in the world today. And so questions about who sets the rules for how cyberspace is used and by whom and under what constraints, if any, is a fundamental question that is going to directly impact so much of economic growth, not to mention military applications in the future, that the lack of a concrete answer to that is in some ways profoundly troubling. And how we answer it is profoundly important. So what I want to do in the 10 minutes that I have is first give everybody a bit of a state of play of where we are right now in that question, and then identify the four or five vectors of conflict that I see coming down the road, and then I'll throw it over to Herb for some of his thoughts. So where are we right now? The internet basically has grown up without any firm international grounded legal regime covering its operation and structure. That is to say, there is no international institution that claims responsibility for setting the rules in the same way as, for example, the World Customs Organization sets the rules for customs around the globe, or the UN claims its authority to govern the lawfulness of war. That is a product, of course, of the fact that the internet was principally developed in the private sector, and such governance as has developed around it has developed through a series of consensus-based international non-governmental organizations who have operated by and large for the last 10, 12 years, some of them are even older, without any formal sanction by the UN or by nation states. The two principal ones that have the leading role right now are the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force, and ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. The IETF is, as its name suggests, an engineering group. They are a consensus-based organization of internet engineers who set basic standards and protocols for internet information transmission. So when you hear about IP addresses, internet protocol addresses, it is the IETF that sets the rules about how those should be configured and defined, much like setting the rules that the return address should be in the top left corner of a mail of an envelope and the zip code at the end of the main body rather than at the beginning. And since we're talking about automated systems, how you configure it, how you break packets apart, how you structure their transmission across the network and their reassembly at their destination in an automated fashion is an extremely important set of technical protocols. The beauty of the IETF is that it's a consensus-based organization that comes up essentially with gold standards. And once those standards are set, anybody can use them. That way, anybody who wants to hook a new application on to the network, so long as they use the established protocols, is confident that their message will be heard and received. ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, that's the group that essentially assigns the names. They're the people who keep the registry of addresses and phone numbers. They're the people who decide that Microsoft.com should resolve to a set of servers out in Washington owned by a man named Bill Gates and not to a competing company of small Microsoft hand towels that is operating in Florida or something like that. And that institution was originally exclusively controlled by Americans and was hived off by the United States to this international NGO, ICANN, back in the late 1990s. An amazingly, by the way, self-abnegating effort by the United States, one for which we probably don't get adequate credit. But as you can see from that basic description, the rules about who sets up addresses, how the information gets transmitted, are set by these two nonprofit NGOs. And neither of them it has any interest currently in setting any rules about content restriction, so that you monitor what goes across the network, or about rules relating to security, authentication, identification. They say that that's somebody else's job and not theirs. So they are quite content just to make the system operate as best it can. Into this, what is essentially void of concrete content rule, has stepped recently the International Telecommunications Union, the ITU. The ITU is an institution that predates the formation of the UN and was, in its initial formulation, a very technical organization that set rules like what wavelengths should be used for radio transmissions, emergency transmissions, what protocols should be used for those emergency transmissions, and also things like setting the country codes. That's what they're the group that says that the United States is +1 and Germany is +34 in the dialing system. Again, pretty technical. At a meeting, however, in Dubai, in the UAE, just this past December, the ITU proposed that it would take greater responsibility for managing the Internet. And in particular, under the guise of, and guise is perhaps too strong a word, but under the rubric of preventing spam, they proposed an international content monitoring regime, which is to say that, of course, you can't stop spam if you don't monitor the content to identify what spam is. This set of proposals, both to give the ITU responsibility for the network, and to allow or authorize in international law significant content monitoring, more or less freaked out the liberal West, the United States, Europe, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, because it was thought that that was going to authorize authoritarian countries, China, Russia, being main proponents of this, to, in international law, restrict and limit the content of what goes across the network. So that set of events kind of poses the big divide between a group of essentially Western democracies who see the need for internet freedom-based approaches to internet governance, and a group of other countries, quite authoritarian in nature, who essentially approve of a law of rules rather than the rule of law, that would provide for sovereign control over the internet and the content that goes across it. Layered across that, and I'll make two final points and then throw it over to Herb for more discussion. Layered across that are two other things that need to be in the back of our minds that perhaps we can talk about more later. One is that that set of disputes is essentially one between sovereigns over whether and how institutions of sovereign international law and control should manage the internet and change the current structures, if at all. And it excludes, to a large degree, any consideration of the non-governmental individuals who oppose any sovereignization of the network. And I'm referring to groups of non-state actors like Anonymous, LulzSec, other types of hackers, other people who see the internet as a place that is or ought to be free of sovereign control of any form, whether by the liberal West or by the authoritarian East. And then the last piece that I'll layer on, and this is my transition to the stuff that that Dr. Lin wants to talk about, is that, as I've described it, it's all about economics and law. And we haven't talked yet about the other piece of this, which is a discussion about warfare in cyberspace. With that, Herb?
I, too, am delighted to be here. This is my first Federalist Conference. I was happy to talk about things. What I wanted to engage here was the different side of this, which is that governance also refers to international law and treaties and so on that people have signed in the past to govern matters that are related to war and peace and so on. And it comes as no news to anyone these days that cyberspace is an environment in which conflict can occur, and sometimes that conflict can occur between nation states. By conflict here, I'm referring both to sort of a generic word would be hacking, as the Chinese might put it, or as our Defense Department might put it, offensive cyber operations. That is, things that are done to another party's computer system to corrupt it, exploit it, take advantage of it in some way. There are two dimensions of that. One is an attack dimension. The other is an exploitation dimension. The attack refers to things that are actually destructive in intent. That is, you want to destroy the other guy's computer, corrupt his data, deny him the services that the computer provide, that his computers provide, and so on. Exploitation is when you go there and steal, although it's not really stealing. What it is exfiltrating. It's copying information that he would rather you not see. And in the best of all cases, when from the exploiter's point of view, the guy that you're stealing it from never knows that you've been there. So those are two different kinds of conflict that you might consider. People have come up with have thought about how to regulate this kind of hostile activity in cyberspace. People have been thinking about this for a while. I mean, obviously not for as long as they've been thinking about how to deal with the stuff when nuclear weapons are involved. But recently there have been a variety of proposals and thoughts about that. And what I wanted to do was to broadly go about speaking about what sorts of things people have talked about. There is in fact no progress on any of this stuff. It's those discussions between governments are just starting to get underway, at least in part because we're trying to figure out what we want as a nation. In general, there are three kinds of agreement that you might come to with another party. There's limitations on capability, on things that you can do, that you have the ability to do. For example, in the missile business, it's you can only have so many missiles. There are restrictions on use, you forbid You come to an agreement that you won't target each other's hospitals, for example. That's part of the laws of war. We agree with other nations that we will not target their hospitals. So that you can do. Or you can say that there are certain activities that are not allowed during peacetime or something like that. And then there's another broad category, which I'm going to call confidence building. The idea here is that you do things that reassure the other guy that your intentions are benign, to reduce the possibility of conflict by accident, by miscalculation, by failure of communication. And to enhance your understanding of what might otherwise be a kind of a black box. So traditionally there have been, for example, in the conventional, in the non-cyber world, there are agreements that with the Russians, for example, that we notify them and they notified us when they're about to launch a ballistic missile so that we don't mistake it for an attack, things like that. Now, there are a lot of people. There are a lot of skepticism about whether or not these kinds of capability, whether or not these kinds of agreements can apply to cyberspace. A lot of that skepticism is indeed well founded. I mean, so I prefer to talk about them as challenges because I would like to find a way to do it. People who are sort of on the other side who don't want to come to any kinds of agreements say that these are insurmountable obstacles. But in any case, we both agree that we don't know how to solve these problems now. Consider, for example, the idea of limiting capabilities in cyberspace. On occasion, you hear people say that there should be a ban on offensive weapons in cyberspace. Well, I mean, this gets to be a very strange discussion once you probe it. For example, some offensive capabilities have legitimate use. For example, if I am a company and I want somebody to test my defenses, I want to hire somebody who can attack my systems. And that's a good thing. Some good guy ought to have that. This is the ethical hacker business. Those capabilities are perfectly legitimate and good. If I want to test my defenses, I should have, real attacks to test them against. You can't limit the hardware that you need for large-scale attacks. That is, you can go down to Best Buy or Staples and buy the technology. So the technology infrastructure is easily available. It's not like nuclear weapons. The necessary software for some kind of cyber attack you can download for free off the internet. Sometimes it's written in Chinese, sometimes it's written in English, but they have point-and-click interfaces, and it's all very convenient for just the random person to go download. And you can get that for free. And the human infrastructure that you need and the technical infrastructure that you need to conduct even a large-scale cyber attack is much smaller than what's needed to conduct a good cyber defense. That is, a small number of people can have very large effects, whereas the defense has to be huge because it has to cover everything, all of the targets of interest. So it's very, very problematic to limit capabilities here. And furthermore, you can't verify that. How would I ever verify that another nation didn't have certain software? I mean, this just borders on the ridiculous. Right, there's offensive software that I can put onto a CD-ROM and it'll just sit offline. And I mean, how will anybody get it? So those kinds of proposals are gestures proposals. You can think about restrictions on use, similar to we're not going to use lasers to blind soldiers, or we're not going to attack hospitals or something like that. That's, you could do that. So, for example, some people have proposed agreements that we will not target each other's power grids, or we will not target each other's national financial systems or something like that. And there are – one can certainly make a stated intent declare our stated intent not to do that, much as we abide by the laws of war right now. We agree not to do certain things, and we can't verify, quote, verify that, because we have to show that they're not going to do it. And how do you show that you don't do it? Well, you don't do it until, hopefully, that lasts forever. Well, would we trust that the other guy wouldn't do it? Well, we enter into the laws of war without any assurance that the other guy will comply. And we say it's in our interest to obey the laws of war, whether or not the other guy is. And maybe there's such a regime that's available that would make sense in cyberspace. So there are advantages to this. It creates international norms, and we're better off if everybody says this is a bad idea, because at least then you can't overtly threaten to do it. So there could be possibilities there. Probably most useful before conflict breaks out. After conflict breaks out, you could argue that you don't know what's going to happen. But at least before, it might make some sense. There are many complicating factors to any restrictions on use. So, for example, the fact that attacks often look like exploitations and vice versa. That is, if I send in a software agent to spy on your system, and it's merely to, merely to collect information, unquote, how do you know that that's what it's doing? Are you going to assume the best that that's a benign software agent? Well, maybe not. Depends on the circumstances. So how you verify that, in fact, the other guy is abiding by something like that is an interesting question. If I say no attacks on power grids, but does that mean I can spy on your power grid? Or are you going to say that I can't do intelligence collection on your power grid? Now that changes the calculus entirely. So there's all sorts of complicating issues there. From the standpoint of confidence building measures and transparency, there are other things that you could do. Like as I said, in traditional arms control, you have agreements to prevent dangerous incidents at sea and notification of movement of troops and ballistic missile launches and the like. Are there things that you can do in cyberspace? Well, perhaps. But I think that nobody knows what they might be. For example, could there be a hotline between the United States and China to talk about cyber incidents? Well, I've been told that there is a hotline, and I've been told that every now and then when we test the thing, the Chinese sometimes don't answer the phone. That doesn't build confidence. So once you the fact that you establish these things means that there has to be some national commitment to make it work. The other thing is, would you ever trust the communication coming over the hotline? You would worry that it was intended to deceive you. I mean, that's what cyber is all about in a sense, right? That the attacks that you promote and that you facilitate and so on are all based on some sort of deception. And so why would a communication coming over the hotline be treated any differently? And the other thing is that agreed conventions for behavior, they don't cover intent, and people worry about intent. And the last point is that how you actually gather information to make sure that the other guy is actually complying with any stated agreement is very, very difficult. It could be very intrusive, and it's not clear that either side would allow those sorts of things to happen. Are some agreements possible? Well, if you want to start talking to the other guys, yes. I mean, you could agree on terminology, just on a shared vocabulary. The U.S. and China, for example, have very different views of what deterrence is all about. We think it's the cornerstone of our defense policy. The Chinese see deterrence as a kind of intimidation. So when we say we want to deter hostile parties, they say, no, you're trying to intimidate us. That's not an interest. You know, that's not a good situation to be in when you don't even share the right words. Sometimes they share ideas, but the ideas are wrong. So both in the United States and in China, you have senior leaders saying that cyber is like cyber attacks and cyber weapons are like nuclear weapons, which is wholly nonsense. There are shared misunderstandings as well. Is there promise for some sort of international agreement here? Perhaps. But I think that from my perspective, the idea is to start small. That is, start trying to agree on places where you have common interests, like trying to understand each other and what each other is, how each other thinks about the problem, and try to clear up misunderstandings like cyber is like nuclear and so on. That's at least a place to start. Am I optimistic for the future? Perhaps. I don't know. But it's certainly worth trying. With that, Dean.
Thank you so much. Let's turn things over to the audience now. We're going to open the floor to your questions in a moment. We'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that prompt, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Stand by for that. So once again.
Hey, this is Rod Sullivan at Florida Coastal School of Law. I had the privilege of teaching over in Korea earlier this year, and some of my students advised me that there was internet regulation in Korea, in South Korea, of obscenity and pornography. And as a purely academic matter, of course, I would never do it any other form. I searched for pornography on the internet there and didn't find any. And I also recall that when the Chinese put in their internet blocking programs, Green Dam, that one of their primary reasons or justifications was to shield the Chinese people from pornography, which primarily emanated from the United States. And I guess my question to you is this an area where we have grounds for international cooperation, or is that simply just too much of a restriction on First Amendment freedoms and something on which we're not going to be able to agree?
Go ahead, Paul.
This is Paul. I think.
No, I know you don't know anything about pornography itself, but in a generalized sense, yes.
I know nothing about pornography either. I want that record clear on the record. But your point is a well taken one, which is that the technology for content filtering is neutral as to what the content is. Some very otherwise liberal countries like Australia do content filtering now. They do it for child pornography, right? And we understand that, and we accept that that is something on which we might even agree at some point, though I don't think the U.S. government will ever get in the business of filtering. The challenge, as Herb said in the military context, is limiting, is, you know, building up confidence and limiting the use of this of the tech to areas of international agreement. The concern of some is that once we write into international law a principle upholding the idea that nation states may filter content, the genie is out of the bottle, so to speak.
Yeah, I guess that was part of my question, too, is if you do filter content for, let's say, child pornography, isn't it just a short step to filtering political content?
It is. I guess the flip of it, people on the other side would say, look, nation states are doing it now irrespective of the absence of international law justifying their behavior, or formal international law, and that we are essentially beginning the creation of a customary international law that accepts that some things may be filtered, and we just have yet to consensus on what things are that everybody will agree on. Herb?
Dr. Lin,
no,
do you want to weigh in here?
Sure. Let me jump off of what Paul said, which is that the technology is in fact neutral in some sense, but more to first order, it is neutral about what can and can't be filtered, and it's a question of making value judgments and so on. Let me jump off from that.
Let me posit three different scenarios for the world, okay, about how the Internet is governed. The first scenario is the American position dominates, and free speech reigns everywhere, and all the other nations of the world say, yes, 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 we want that too. Okay, that's scenario one. Scenario two is that the world fractures, and that there's the liberal democracies go one way with free speech and so on, and the authoritarian nations of the world go another way with their restrictions on content, and then there are two different internets, and maybe there are gateways in between them for specifically monitored things like controlled things like commerce and so on. Okay, that's scenario two. So obviously these guys have different rules regarding free speech. And scenario three is that the Internet stays whole in some sense with one set of rules, but the United States has to make compromises with its values, obviously, because this isn't scenario one. This is scenario three, where the U.S. has to, you know, give some way. Okay, so, for me, I prefer scenario one. Okay, I'm an American. I want scenario one to be the case, but I'm not sure I believe that that's a likely outcome. So, let me start by asking Paul. How would you rank scenarios two and three, in terms of desirability? Scenario two is we fracture the Internet, and the authoritarian guys go one way and liberal democracies go the other. Or scenario two is the Internet stays whole, only the U.S. has to compromise on its values to a certain degree.
Fascinating.
How would you rank them? And then this is actually a question for thought for anybody else who wants to weigh in on this discussion.
It's a fascinating question, Herb, and the lawyer in me wants to say, I guess the answer is it depends what the compromises are, of course. You know, modest compromises on free expression, like a uniform rule against child pornography, certainly don't offend. Significant compromises that restrict creativity, innovation of products, freedom of political speech would, and I'd probably pick a fractured network over that.
Okay, I think we've got Dr. Lynn back. Are you there?
No.
Okay. Perhaps not. Well, we've got a couple more questions in the queue. Why don't we carry on without Dr. Lynn and go to our next caller?
Hi. Well, it's going to be awkward without Dr. Lynn, but...
He'll be back.
I'm sure. It seems to me that a better question might be whether we're going to require the states to enforce their own restrictions, or whether we're going to allow states to export their restrictions to other states. Cases of like swastikas and Google in France come to mind. And to what extent are nations going to be required to, well, if you don't want that in France, you should perform content filtering at a technical level within France and impose the cost on the French people and the French government to have that restriction? Or are we going to allow countries like France, in this particular case, to, you know, sue perhaps out of existence the likes of Google because they don't like what Google does? And I'm curious, I realize the Federalist Society is...
Dean Reuter's voice line, please. This is Herb Lynn. I'm supposed to be on a conference call.
You're on there, Dean.
You're on it.
Herb Lynn, Herb, you're on it. We can hear you. Can you hear us?
This is Herb Lynn.
Herb Lynn. All right, Paige. Anyway, whether we're going to use technical means or legal means, to solve these problems. Speaking strictly as a technologist, I don't think legal means are going to work. So I would go for scenario two over scenario three every day of the week, because I don't think you can make scenario three work.
Now, that's a fascinating perspective. This is Paul, And I completely agree with you that the technology is going to continue to outstrip the legal regimes no matter where we go with it. As a non-technologist who's tried to learn the technology, I've gotten to the point where I've stopped predicting what the future will bring. So I wouldn't even be confident that but that leads me to ask you the reverse question, which is, how confident are you that the technical means can be implemented and not circumvented?
I can always whisper. I've always been able to whisper, and I will forever have the capability of whispering. And, you know, the notion that states can restrict speech based on content or anything else simply because it takes place over a wire is where the flaw enters the argument.
I tend to agree with you, but in the end, if you're in an authoritarian regime, they can outlaw whispering, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. I mean, yeah. one of the most restrictive laws I know of is the internet law of the country of Belarus, which makes it a felony punishable by imprisonment to access any website that does not have a .be, which is the Belarus extension. Yeah. You know? And they enforce it through rigorous monitoring through the one national ISP and through prosecutions of internet cafe owners. So it's, you know, they've outlawed whispering, in effect, with felony punishment.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. It's Doug Eby at Omni Capital. I'm not sure if this is the right forum, but I was curious if you had some comments on the Kim.com extradition battle that's going on between the United States and New Zealand. And secondly, if you do, and this is the right forum, you know, what are your thoughts about the case's implications as a precedent-setting case for the future of digital IP?
Well, this is Paul, and I assume Herb's not back on the line yet. I have some. It's not exactly in the zone, but it's certainly worth talking about because, I mean, one of the things that it actually demonstrates is that even within the so-called liberal West, there are uncertainties in agreement about fundamental values. Here you're talking about IP, a much more common axis of divergence is between, say, the U.S. and Europe over privacy regulations. Even Herb's fractured network might be more than just two. It could be three, four, or five. As for Kim.com's, case itself, the last time I looked at it, I read the indictment, and if the allegations of the indictment are true, he seemed to be pretty extreme on the end of the information should always be free portion of it, and just as a general matter, if we don't have a means of compensating content providers for the content they create, in the end we'll get less content or less good content. I don't have much more to say than that, though.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dean Reuter again. We've dialed out to Dr. Lin. I don't know if he can hear us or if we can hear him. Herb Lin, are you there?
I can hear you.
Okay. We can hear you, too.
Well, then why don't we repose for Herb the interesting question that was the second one?
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Herb. While you were gone, we had a really interesting call from one of the technical people, and his question was whether or not the appropriate means for enforcing, say, a breakup of the network was to require the country of concern to exercise the screening by technical means, like France banning swastikas, or whether it would be a legal response where France could sue the bejeebus out of Google and bankrupt them for importing swastikas into France. And he pumped for the first of those, the technological answer, but he wanted your response.
Well, I think that in the end, both methods are going to be explored. One could require. The question is,
who should bear the cost of it, right? Who should bear the cost of all? Should it be France who has to put the technical means into place, or should it be Google that has to do things in accordance with French law? And that's just a question of cost shifting, right? I don't have an opinion on which is the better way to do it. Except, you know, if I were a major Google stockholder, I might have an opinion on that. I wish I were a major Google stockholder. But it seems to me that's essentially a political decision. Neither approach is going to be fully effective. And one could argue that if you really want to be 100%, not 100%, but more effective, you have to do both.
Doesn't that suggest, Herb, then that if it's cost shifting, we should shift the cost to whoever is the least cost avoider, the person for whom the cost would be minimized?
Well, yeah, except that it's not France wants to ban swastikas for everybody. It's not that France wants to ban swastikas only for people who don't like swastikas. There's a sense in which local filtering is probably the most, is probably the easiest way to do it. If I don't want to see pornography, I can sort of set my personal filters to say no pornography, and that's fine, and you can do that. The real question is that what governments want to do, and lots of other institutions too, want to do is to prevent it for everybody. And so that means you have to go for the point of highest leverage. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but.
Interesting. Do you have any more questions in the queue, Dean, or should I?
We do not. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question for either of our experts.
While we're waiting, I'm still curious as to what I proposed. I don't know if you got all of the, my scenarios 2 and 3. I'd be curious, Paul, do you have a view on which of those is a more desirable outcome? Where scenario 2 is where it fractures, and scenario 3 is we have to compromise?
I did answer that while you were off the phone, but my answer was you have to tell me more what I'm compromising, how much, right? Obviously, if the compromise is accepting a world without child pornography, since that barely registers a ripple on my First Amendment freedom-o-meter, in fact, doesn't register any ripple, I'm content with that.
Right.
On the other end of the scale, if it means allowing restrictions on what is acceptable political speech, mm-hmm. No, I'd take the fracturing in a heartbeat.
Okay.
I obviously there's a gray line and some place to draw it somewhere.
Okay. For anybody out there listening, it would be very interesting to hear what you had to say about it and that kind of question and why.
Our phone lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button if you'd like to join the conversation. But, gentlemen, it looks like we're out of questions at this point unless you want to continue the conversation between the two of you.
Well, obviously we're not that interesting.
Hold on. I've perhaps spoke too soon. Let's see. It looks like we have maybe what is a final question. Let's see if we can go to this question.
Yeah, Richard Ralph here again, caller 2.
The tech guy. Yeah. Good. So you can
the tech guy. Yeah. For me, COSE applies here, and it's
yep.
more important to make it clear who has the responsibility in advance than it is precisely whose responsibility it is at the end of the day. It's just the certainty is required, and because of that, and because laws are written in language and language is imprecise, I'm going to always prefer imposing the restrictions via technology, because that is precise, even if the costs are higher for France to eliminate from eBay every swastika image that may occur, that's up to France to decide whether that restriction is worth the cost. But I don't want to see the likes of eBay sued out of existence over the uncertainty of whether or not, you know, somebody's tile pattern constitutes a swastika.
I understand where you're coming from. France may have a different view of that.
Yeah, and for me, I would impose on France, okay, you don't want that on the internet, then France, you have to, you know, put a huge firewall at the boundary and filter out the content of anybody who's not willing to play by your rules. If that means eBay is off limits to all the French because eBay won't sign up to obey these rules, so be it.
That's the Chinese approach.
Exactly. You know, I don't like the Chinese approach, but compared to the alternative, where, you know, France can threaten to, you know, threaten the livelihood of everybody who works at eBay in the United States simply because, you know, somebody got offended in France, it's an easy call.
Understood.
You know, I've two further points in response. You know, COSE only takes you so far, right? The COSE theorem suggests that it's the allocation responsibility is irrelevant in the absence of transaction costs. But here we know that there are huge transaction costs on either side. So we do want to try and figure out which one of them is likely to have the higher transaction cost. And then the other point that I think is kind of worth making is that it seems to me that in some ways the isolation of markets will in the long run be self-defeating, right? Okay. That is, that if people hide behind great Chinese firewalls or, you know, exclude themselves from eBay, then in the end, and it may be in the long run end, but in the end, much as, you know, the economic factors are what in the end brought communism down over the last over a century, the same economic factors will drive the countries that hide behind these walls to drop them in the end or try to.
Yeah.
Well, that's an optimistic view of it, I would love to believe that. In the long run, that free speech. You know, I'm as an American, I believe that as a point of ideology, that free speech is a good thing to have, and that it supports economic prosperity and development. Okay, and I believe that. But do I? That's a belief. I don't think I can give you any proof for that. And in fact, other nations may be willing to accept smaller rates of growth and so on in return for some degree of restriction on free speech. And maybe, maybe those guys are going to survive just as well as we are. Don't know.
Well, gentlemen, this is Dean Reuter. It looks like we've exhausted the questions from the audience. Let me, before we conclude the call, give each of you a chance to express any final thoughts. And why don't we start with Paul Rosenzweig, Paul?
We did not get to talk to, and the one piece that I will hold out there as an additional thing to consider is the discussion that we've just been having assumes that non-state actors, groups that are committed to an internet freedom ideal, are willing to accept France's decision to keep eBay offline, it is not clear to me that will always be a technological capability that France will have, or that China will have, and that in the long run it may even be that our discussion about a country's willingness to hide behind firewalls will give way to the battering ram of those who insist that there be no firewalls on the net at all, which would pose an even greater set of internet governance problems.
I agree with the question. If I were to put money on it, I would bet on the nations rather than on these anonymous groups. That's not a sure bet. By any means, Paul could be right about that, but I think the reason is that perfection is not needed to get more or less what you want. The Chinese firewalls aren't perfect either, right? Even right now, there are lots of people. There's a big cat and mouse game going on, and the Chinese know it. They don't have to be perfect. They just have to be good enough to support their political ends. And they do a very fine job of it. It's hard for me to imagine that the anonymouses of the world were trying to break that down. I mean, more power to them. I encourage the breakdown of the Chinese firewalls for political content and so on. I don't want them there. And the more that can be done, the better, from my standpoint as an American citizen. But it's not perfect. It's not perfect. But I think the Chinese do a pretty good job of it. And it serves their needs. So,
well, let me thank you both on behalf of the Federalist Society, Paul Rosenzweig, Dr. Herbert Lin. We certainly appreciate you sharing our thoughts, and thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.